Welcome, fellow monkeys, to Spider on the Web number 67 and News of a New Earthling. Jeannie and I are overjoyed to report that on Thursday, 28 May, at 1:52 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, our daughter Terry Luana gave birth to our granddaughter, Marissa Alegria da Silva. 8 pounds, 5 ounces, long, slim, healthy, and supernaturally beautiful, Marissa arrived several weeks past her nominal due date, and after a heroic 36-hour home water birth attempt, by C-section at St. Vincent's Hospital on 14th Street in Manhattan. This gives her what I believe to be literally the coolest possible vintage on this planet. My granddaughter Marissa was born both in the Bronx and in the Village. That's about as hip as it gets. She'll go far. Jeannie and I were there to welcome her to Terra with our amazing son-in-law Heron and his splendid parents, Big Heron and Suede da Silva, who had flown up from Rio for the occasion. My Portuguese is pretty much limited to bom dia and obrigado, and Big Heron's English is basically John Lennon. We lived together for over a week in a tiny apartment and got along great, singing Beatles songs and Joe Beam songs until the world looked level, drinking caipirinhas and wolfing Sueli's incredible Brazilian cooking. Jeannie and I also got to spend precious time making happy memories with my sister Mary, her husband John, our nieces Jeannie and Megan, and nephew Patrick, who has become a seriously good guitarist. Because little Marissa waited so long to make her entrance, I only had time to see and converse with her once, all too briefly, before I had to sprint for my flight home. But it was long enough for me to make this report by email to half my address book the moment I got home. Like her mother and both grandmothers, Marissa is a strong little warrior woman, grip on her like an acrobat, fearless as a newborn can be, heartbeat like Charlie Hayden's bass, perfect toes, long, lean, hairy-headed, and impossibly beautiful in all respects. So, as you can see, I had time to observe her closely. I hummed her first song to her, "Here Comes the Sun," near her ear with my finger on her tummy for conduction as well. Blister right out. Just that was worth the whole trip to me. And, of course, I've been Skyping her ever since I got home. And I just got the following email from my darling Jeannie. "Hi, Bronx boy. Today I sat on a bench in Moshaloo Park, soaking up the rays for a time, while Heron and Lou drove with Marissa to the mall to run an errand. Heron said he'd drop me off at Van Cortlandt Park, but I told him I wanted to go to Moshaloo. I wanted to sit on a bench that your mother may have sat on while watching you play in the grass. I wanted to imagine Lou pushing Marissa and her new stroller through this same park all summer long. I wanted to sit in amazement at our family's past, present, and future, all tied somehow to the Bronx. Today, as I rocked Marissa while listening to one of the CDs you made for her, I was transported to our early days, when we sang Stevie's words over and over again as we looked into each other's eyes. We can conquer the world in love, you and I, you and I, you and I." And here we are, still doing our best to live together in harmony in this crazy, crazy world. In love, you and I, you and I. You and I. We have so much to be grateful for, from Moshaloo to Medford to Plainview to the Bay of Fundy to Halifax to Vancouver to Bowen Island and then back to the Bronx again. What a story we've created. Baby, I'm amazed. With deep, endless love, Jeannie." So am I, sweetheart. So am I. Okay, enough about the personal lives of Spider and Jeannie Robinson. On to a new and more absorbing topic, the professional lives of Spider and Jeannie Robinson. Now, two podcasts ago, I left you hanging at the end of Chapter 1 of our third novel, Starmind. I intend to pick up where I left off and read you as much more as we have room for. But before we start, I'm going to play you a short lullaby by the late, great Paul Penna. In the days before he became the world champion Tuvan throat singer and subject of the Oscar-nominated documentary Genghis Blues, back when he was just a truly great San Francisco blues singer, who, by the way, originally hailed from the Azores, so I'm betting he would have understood Heron's Portuguese. Here's Paul Penna and Lullaby.
child, make your way in this world of strangers. You must go, child, time has come, can't hold you back from the dangers. If you need a friend tonight, I'll be your friend. If you don't make it home all right, I'll take you in. Go work hard, boy, make your way in this world of savagery. When you can, boy, lend a hand to folks in need like you and me. But if you get knocked down, I'll take you in. And if you don't make it home all right, I'll be your friend. It's been a long, long time since I've seen you in my town. You need help in a bad way, but I don't see you around. You just gotta find your own way. Just relax, settle down. Lord, it's all over town. This old world's coming down. Take your rest. I will sing my song, sweet charm your heart. Listen to me. Think of me often. I'll think of you, as though we won't be apart. If you need a friend tonight, I'll take. If you don't make it home all right, I'll be your friend. Yes, I will tonight. Go ahead and love him. Show him what life's about, like I've shown you. Love him hard, darling. He's a man. He needs it like all of us do. But if he throws you out tonight, I'll take you in. If you don't make it home all right, I'll be your friend. Show nothing to me. Love. Love is all we need. You just gotta stop taking me. Sunny days will shine on you. You say with your heart you want them to. Try to lend a friendly hand. What we need to make a better land, yeah. Let me try to show you how. Not sometime in the future, but right now. Don't make it home all right, I'll take you in. If you need a friend tonight, I'll be your friend.
That was from a sadly long out-of-print Capitol album called Pulpenna. Hunt it down online if you can. It's worth it. We now resume the reading of Star Mine by Spider and Jeannie Robinson, but unlike the first chapter I read you live two casts ago, this reading comes directly from the recently released Blackstone audiobook edition of Star Mine, which completes their coverage of the entire Stardance trilogy. What you hear is what you'll get. Here we go. Take it, Spider.
Chapter 2. Rand Porter had been waiting for that question, of course. Their 8-year-old would get a better education if he took the job. Rhea had known that when she'd asked the question. On his new salary, they could afford to enroll Collie in any school on or off Earth with full bandwidth and as much individual attention as she wanted. Hell, they could afford to have teachers physically brought up to her if they wanted in corporation shuttles. And Rhea could have unlimited net access herself, too. And all these things, he added, would be merely perks, over and above a salary so immense that they could easily have afforded to pay for them. Full medical would be another such perk. Rhea's literary reputation could only benefit from all the publicity that would accrue. Rand stressed all these points without ever quite saying aloud a point that mattered to him almost as much as the honor or the creative challenge or the prestige or the money, per se. If he took this job, he would be earning more money than Rhea and would be more famous than her, for the first time in their relationship. He couldn't mention that aloud. They had agreed back at the start that they would never mention it. That was how little it meant to them. Therefore, he couldn't bring it up now.
Worst comes to worst, why couldn't we compromise? He suggested desperately. Have one of those commuter marriages. I'd take the job, and you could come up for 3 months out of every six. Lots of people do that when only one half of the team wants to be a spacer.
Sure, she said. That worked out just great for your brother, didn't it? Jay had maintained such a relationship with a dancer in one of his two rotating companies for over 5 years. Then, about 6 months ago, Ethan had sent him a Dear Jay resignation fax from Fire Island. The scabs were just beginning to turn into scar tissue.
We're more committed than Jay and Ethan were, Rand protested.
But privately, he was not sure that was true, and the stats on groundhog spacer marriages were discouraging. When they were exhausted enough, they agreed to sleep on it. At 5 a.m, he slipped from his bed without waking her and went down the hall to his pit. Strains of melody were chasing each other in his head, but when he booted up his synth, he could not isolate any of the strands in his headphones. Sounded aloud, they were an inseparable jangle of discord, like his feelings. So he went to the kitchen and found he was not hungry. He went to the bathroom and discovered he didn't have to pee. He put the headphones back on and learned that he didn't want to hear anything in his collection. He went up to Collie's room and found that she didn't need to be covered. As he bent to kiss her, he startled himself by dropping a tear on the pillow next to her strawberry blonde hair. He went quickly back downstairs to the living room and wept as silently as he could. When he was done, he dried his eyes and blew his nose. What did he need? Well, that was easy. He needed someone to tell him he wasn't a selfish bastard. He had promised her. Worse, he had thought about it first. He had not specifically envisioned this situation, no, but he had made his promise without reservations. No matter what, love. But this offer was beyond any dreams he'd had a decade ago. How could he have known? The carrot was irresistible. Or was it? What was so irresistible? The money would be great. But while they had been middle class for their whole marriage, they had never been poor, never missed a meal. There were other jobs. Indeed, this was about the only job he could possibly take that would require them to move from P-Town, that he couldn't basically phone in. It was certainly the only job that would have required permanent exile. What was so great about the damn job? Two things. It was the most prestigious job in his field, one of the most prestigious there was, and it would make him the principal breadwinner in his family for the first time. Not very proud reasons to break a solemn promise to your wife. No, damn it, there was more to it than that. The job was the richest creative opportunity he had ever had. His 3 month stint just past had been the hardest work he had ever done and had drawn some of his very best music and shaping out of him. Collaborating with his half-brother Jay had been exhilarating. Although Jay was 13 years older than Rand's 35, their minds had meshed.
I see. Your wife will be a little sadder, but your chops will improve.
It wasn't just that. Part of what had made his work better in the Shimizu had been the heart-stopping grandeur of space itself, the bliss of zero-G. Space was as magical as Provincetown in a different way, maybe more so. Surely Rhea would see and respond to that, just as he had.
You hope.
Well, anyway, what was so great about P-Town? Okay, it was beautiful, sure, it was timeless. Granted, it was magical. This chair he was rocking in, for instance. Beautiful and timeless and magical. But it made noises like rifle fire and leaned ever so slightly out of true and wasn't especially comfortable without the pillows that always slipped out of adjustment. So what if it had belonged to Rhea's great-grandmother? So what if it had been the chair in which the infant Rhea had been breastfed, and Collie, too? The answer was all around him, hanging from every wall, perched on nearly every flat surface. Pictures of 8 generations of Pajaus, as far back as the imaging technology allowed, ranging from faded black-and-white daguerreotypes of Cap'n Frank and Marion to paused hollow blocks of Rhea, Collie, and himself. Hundreds of Pajaus and their kin in dozens of settings, and every single image had Provincetown somewhere in the background. Beautiful. Timeless. Magical. On the mantle, amid the more recent Pajaus, was a hollow of Rand's parents, Agnes and Tom, taken just before their divorce. The background was Newark, New Jersey. There was no point to this. He already knew he wanted the job badly enough to take it. Whether he should want it that badly or not seemed irrelevant. Nonetheless, he flogged himself as his penance, endlessly replaying the argument until it became a loop that annihilated time. I want to be great. Is that so terrible? Just as he felt that his brain might explode, 35 kilos of 8-year-old reality landed on his lap like a ton of bricks, shouting, Boo! And his heart nearly exploded instead. Daylight and his daughter had crept up on him. I scared you, Daddy, she reported with glee. I did, didn't I? For an instant he was tempted to use Collie as a new club to beat himself. How can you ask a child to go pioneering? But he shifted gears instead, grabbed her in his arms, and stood up. That you did, baby, he said, clutching her close. That you did.
Did you catch it, Daddy?
Huh?
Whatever made you stay up all night? Did you get it?
Not yet, sweetheart. I got a look at it, but it got away.
Don't matter about it, she advised him. You'll get it next time.
Her optimism and the boundless, unquestioning faith that underlay it floored him. I can't be a bastard, he thought. I'd never have fooled her. He hugged her even closer, making her squeal. That I will, he agreed. Right now, let's you and me get us some grub. I cook, she said quickly. Her faith in him had practical limits. That was why he could trust it. Deal, he agreed. And she did cook a better breakfast than he could have, albeit somewhat more messily. Rhea came in while she was doing it, and stood in the doorway in her bathrobe watching and trying not to smile. Collie refused to let either of them help or even coach. By the time they were all sitting down eating together, it seemed to have been decided that today was a happy day. Rhea's eyes were unguarded when they met his. The issue was still there between them, but it was on hold for the moment. After the meal, it was Rhea who said, Collie, sit back down. You can be a little late for playgroup today. Your father and I need to talk about something with you.
Oh, Mom, do you have to? Sarah's going to bring her cat in today, and she swears it has thumbs.
Yes, honey, it's important.
4 of them. Oh, okay, go ahead.
She sat back and adjusted her nervous system to fidget mode. Rhea handed the ball to him.
Rand?
He cleared his throat. Collie, have you ever thought about living somewhere else?
You mean I'm going to Grandma's house again? How long this time?
No, honey, that's not what I meant. I mean, all 3 of us moving away from here to a new home.
And not coming back?
That's right. Not ever. The notion did not seem to shock Collie.
Where?
She asked practically. Well, remember that time we went to visit Uncle Jay? She got excited.
Go to space, you mean? And stay there? In that cool hotel? Oh, wow!
You really liked it that much? Rhea asked, surprised.
Da, si, ya, oui, Collie said. I'm not little in space.
Both parents were startled into laughter.
It's true, she insisted. I can reach everything there and look grown-ups in the eye. And I'm as strong as anybody and not clumsy like everybody else. Besides, it's fun. When do we go?
Even Rand was taken aback by support this enthusiastic.
But, baby, you know if we stay in free fall for long, we have to stay forever.
Sure.
Well, won't you miss your friends?
She thought about it.
I could still call them up, right? We could hollow play, and they could come visit me really sometimes, and I'd make lots of new friends. I'm good at that.
Rand squelched a grin. Well, yes, you are. But won't you miss this house and P-Town and everything?
And the beach, Rhea prompted. And the ocean?
Collie looked around her.
I guess. But if I do, you could just make it for me, Daddy. Anyway, you can't play six wall here. I tried.
He didn't have to look at his wife to know that she was looking faintly stricken. Her only potential ally had defected. He wanted to put an arm around her, but was not sure whether that would make it worse. Collie had gone from fidget to bounce mode.
Can I go tell everybody now, Daddy? How soon are we going, Mommy? I gotta get dressed. Ooh, Kelly's gonna be so jealous.
Hold your horses, young lady. Nothing's been decided yet. Your mother and I are still discussing the idea.
Collie wasn't listening. Her eyes had gone wide.
Wait a minute. This means you got the job, didn't you, Daddy? You get to work with Uncle Jay now. They picked you. Oh, I knew they would. I told you they would.
Rhea winced.
We are going. We are. Can I tell Kelly now and Sigrid and Bobby?
The choices were let her go or strap her down. Maybe you better get dressed first, Rhea said. Collie looked down at her rumpled pajamas and giggled.
Oh, okay, if you insist, she said
and ran for the stairs. She was naked before she reached the top. Rand and Rhea looked at each other. Each waited for the other to speak, with voice or expression.
We have to laugh, he said finally.
Oh, yeah, why?
Because if we strangle each other, who's going to take Collie to playgroup?
And so they laughed.
Come on, somebody, Collie called from upstairs. Get dressed, I'm almost ready already.
They laughed harder and then got up together and sprinted up the stair, shouting, Yes, ma'am, right away, Your Highness. I still don't see why you have to live there, Rhea said 30 minutes later. They had dropped Collie off at a playgroup in the West End, and now were sitting in the car at the edge of the sea at Herring Cove, half watching a group of 8 or 10 trancers in sleek thermal clothing, dancing on the shore, spinning and jumping in the December breeze, falling and recovering, but always springing back up at once. They made Rand think, as always, of birds trying to batter their way through an invisible ceiling. Provincetown had been a magnet for trancers since the strange fad had begun and spread around the planet with the speed of a catchphrase. P-Town had always been a mecca for all kinds of odd behavior.
It's stupid, Rhea went on. It's just stupid elitist thinking. There's no sensible reason why you can't phone it in like any other job. They only have the best hollow gear in human space.
That's what the Shimizu is all about, Rand said patiently. That's what they're buying. The most conspicuous consumption there is. Nothing canned, nothing piped in.
I know. The celebrity artists are all on site for the customers to press flesh with, and half the robot work is done by human beings just to prove they can afford to waste money. Snob logic.
You can't make art for a place without going there, he said. Hollow isn't enough. I can't explain why, but it isn't. I always go to the site if there is one, at least at first. You know all this.
Well, so you've been there for 3 months. Isn't that enough?
It was a fair question. He tried to find the words to answer it. All he could come up with was, space is different.
Different how?
Look, you were there.
For 3 days.
Long enough to get a taste. Now tell me, can you remember what it was like? She started to answer, then stopped.
No, she said finally.
I can remember what I told people about it. I can remember what I wrote about it. But no, you're right, I can't remember what it was like. Not really. I have a lingering feeling about it.
If you had to write a poem about it right now, could you? Or a story set there?
Her shoulders slumped. I'd have to go back for longer than a few days, and either write it there or right after I got back down.
That's why Nagani bullied the board into putting in writing a provision that his successors would have to live in-house. And that's why Jay bullied them into honoring the agreement when Nagani died.
This was all old ground. They had had this conversation over a year ago when he had first become a candidate for the position. He saw her, momentarily, as a trapped animal doubling back on its tracks in search of a way out overlooked earlier, and felt a pang of guilt. She gestured at the ocean and half a world of clouds, at the crazy trancers moving in harmony, then turned and gestured in the other direction at P-Town.
And all of this we're supposed to give up, forever, so that Willem Nagani's artistic vision isn't violated.
The question was so unfair that he returned fire with some irritation.
Only if we want me to have the job.
She left the car and walked a short way along the beach past the gyrating dancers. By the time she returned, he had cooled down and she looked chilly despite her thermally smart clothing. The trancers, too, had finally run out of manic energy and were dispersing, looking blissed out.
"How about this?" Rand said as the car heater switched on to normalize the temperature in the vehicle. "We give it a couple of months. I'll complete Pribara's season. Then if you absolutely hate it, I'll quit."
"You couldn't break your contract."
"Well, hell, Pribara did. I'll reserve the right. If they want me bad enough, they'll negotiate. It's perfectly reasonable considering they're wrecking my whole schedule on no notice at all. By rights, they ought to be paying me a whopping bonus. If they don't like it, let them give Mazursky and Choi socks full of dung and let them fight it out."
She thought about it. Two more months wouldn't be long enough to change you into a spacer. And it's long enough for me to form an opinion.
"I promise if you want to come back, there won't be an argument."
The device didn't fool either of them. He could see that in her eyes. But it brought the situation a little closer to tolerable. It would buy some time.
"How soon would we have to leave?"
"I'll call Jay."
Chapter 3. Yawarra, Queensland, Australia, 2 December 2064. At about that moment, not too far from the opposite point on the planet's surface, ancient woman switched off her ancient compact disc player, brushed the headphones out of her hair with a palsied hand, and decided it was time for sleep. Or at least for bed. Slowly and carefully, she got up from her rocking chair, then used it to steady herself while she removed the denim shorts, which were her only clothing. She walked with halting steps through the darkness to her bed, but when she reached it, she dropped easily and comfortably into a squat beside it. Reaching beneath it, she drew out her chamber pot and removed the lid. When she maneuvered it beneath her, its weight and a small sloshing sound reminded her that she had forgotten to empty it that morning. As she was about to put it to its accustomed use, she suddenly stopped, clamping her sphincter and flaring her nostrils. Her head turned from side to side twice. Then she looked down between her legs, bent her head lower, and sniffed. She took the chamber pot from beneath her and brought it to her nose and sniffed again. She knew then, but nonetheless she reached up and got matches from the bed table. In the sudden flaring light, her eyes confirmed what her nose had told her. Her chamber pot contained wine. It delighted her. It had been a long time since anything had surprised her. This was a good one. She thought about it, savoring the puzzle. No one had approached her home closer than 100 yards all day. She had not left it for a moment. She had not emptied the utensil after using it that morning, she was sure of that. She might be old, no, ancient, but her memory was still sharp as the long edge of a war boomerang. There was no logical explanation. So she went inside herself to her special place. And at once contradictory things happened on her face. Her eyes brightened, and bitter tears spurted from them, and years, no, decades, melted from her visage, and her mouth smiled while her brows knotted in a fierce frown. She glanced across the room at her CD player, and ran a hand across her head to confirm that she had taken its headphones off.
"Badunjari," she whispered, and cocked her head as if listening.
Whatever she heard caused her to smile even wider and weep even harder. But the frown relaxed. She sat back on her heels and began to rock slowly from side to side. After a time, she lifted the chamber pot to her lips and drank from it. The wine was excellent, delicious, and immediately powerful. She took a deeper draught.
"Really?"
she said in Yerlanji.
"What is?"
If there was an answer, no microphone could have recorded it. Her tears ceased, the smile remained, and became the mischievous grin of a little girl.
"Okay,"
she agreed, and drank again.
"I will wait and see."
She had not been this happy in 44 years. Magic, real dreamtime magic, was loose in the world again.
Now here's a traditional 2-minute musical interlude to allow you to stretch your ears, clean out your legs, and ease your bladder. Another lullaby. This is Doug Cox with a song from his remarkable album Bone, Bottle, Brass, or Steel called Riley's Lullaby. Information about this remarkable instrumentalist and singer, visit www.dougcox.org. We continue now with Starmind by Spider and Jeannie Robinson.
Part 2. Chapter 4, The Shimizu Hotel, High Orbit, 2 December 2064. Jay Sasaki was in the studio when his AI spoke up.
Phone, Jay. Your brother Rand. Flat screen only.
It waited patiently while he finished a movement phrase for the camera and toweled off sweat.
Thanks, Diaghilev, he said then. Monochrome headshot, minimum audio, accept.
It was the cheapest possible Earth-to-orbit call. Small black-and-white image and rotten sound. Probably relayed on a satellite circuit so old its expiry date began with 19. Rand would have been offended if Jay had tried to reverse the charges, and it was not yet settled whether his kid half-brother could afford to make full-screen color calls to high Earth orbit on his own dollar. Jay spoke before the AI finished producing an image, to let Rand know the circuit was completed.
"Well, how did she take it?"
"She's right here," Rand said. "Ask her yourself."
He swiveled the car phone so that Rhea came into frame. She was smiling wryly.
"Oops," he said gracefully, Jay said. "Hi, Rhea. Well, how did you take it?"
"Rectally," she said sourly.
The joke cued him, first, that Rand would indeed be coming back up to work in the barn, and second, that it would not be a good idea to sound too delighted just yet. Was Rhea coming up with him right away? Was Collie?
"You'll really like it up here, I promise you," he said experimentally.
"I'd better." Good, Rand would arrive still married.
"And Collie will love it. Space was made for kids."
"It must be," she said. "You like it."
But she was smiling. He relaxed, trying not to let the extent of his relief show. The worst that could happen now was that his half-brother's wife would make Rand's life miserable to the end of his days.
"But he'll be able to work with me again."
It would take a lot of the sting out of Ethan not being around anymore.
"We're going to give it a trial period," Rand said.
He swiveled the phone again so that he was back in frame.
2 months, so Rhea and Collie can check it out before they commit themselves.
Jay managed to hold his poker face.
Fortunately, in zero gravity, one's face does not pale as blood pressure drops. If Rhea left in 2 months, Rand would go with her. With the example of Jay's own disaster with Ethan before him, Rand would not risk losing her in a long-distance marriage. Kate was going to have a blowout when she heard this.
"That'll be hard to sell to the board. They want this settled. Face, you know."
"I've got face, too," Rand said. "I require notice before uprooting my family. If the board doesn't like it, they can start running want ads in the trades." Briefly, Jay fantasized telling his brother the whole truth. The primary reason the board had abandoned the audition process and chosen Rand as their shaper was that Jay, feeling reckless in the aftermath of his breakup with Ethan, had privately sent word through the hotel manager that he would quit if they did otherwise. He had just enough clout to pull that off, and no margin at all. If the hotel came out of this looking bad, he was out of a job. He was the most famous living human choreographer of freefall dance, but if he left the Shimizu, where could he go? There were only two other dance companies in space, and neither was hiring. Jay had been a spacer, permanently adapted to zero gravity, for over a decade now. If he could not work in space, he could not work, even if he could have learned to think and choreograph in up-and-down terms all over again. No, he couldn't tell Rand any of this. If he did, Rand would think, would suspect in his heart forever, no matter what Jay said, that Jay had put his job on the line purely and simply because they shared a mother. Rand would never believe the truth, that he was truly the only one of the four candidates who was any damn good, the only one Jay could stand the idea of being locked into working with for the next umpty years. The hole in his self-confidence would founder him, and the realization that Jay's job was on the line would make his problem with his wife even worse. Well, it was up to Jay to see that Rhea didn't opt out. His other choice was to slit his throat. "You're absolutely right. I'll make them see it that way. Shall I call you back with their answer?" Rand shook his head. "We both know they're going to say yes. I can afford to call you now. Full band color." Jay let the grin escape at last. His brother was right. Kate would hate this, but she was committed. As committed as he was. "Damn right. Call me back at the... What the hell time is it down there?" "About 10 in the morning." The Shimizu was on Greenwich time. It was nearly 3 p.m. for Jay. "All right, about supper time. Listen, I don't want to crowd you, but how soon can you come up? The sooner you can make it, the less trouble I'll have selling this trial period." Rand acquired the harried look of someone who is trying to solve a tricky problem while long-distance charges are ticking away. He glanced sideways. "What do you think, hon?" After a time, Rhea's voice came from out of frame. 3 days minimum. I'd like a month. I'd like a year, damn it."
"I think I can get 3 days, no sweat," Jay said cheerfully.
Rand tried for a diversion. "Anything we can bring up for you?"
"Well, if I think of anything, I'll tell you when you call back."
He gave the phone his best grin.
"Listen, this is really great news. Really, Rhea, you'll see. Kiss Blondie for me. Phone off."
As Rand's smiling image dissolved, he went on,
"Diaghilev, where's Kate?"
"In her office, Jay. Do you wish an appointment to see her? She has an opening in her calendar tomorrow at..."
"No, I want her now. She'll see me. ETA 15 minutes.
"Yes, Jay. You're right. Ms. Boswell has accepted for her. 15 minutes from... Mark."
"Shower, please, Diaghilev."
"Yes, Jay."
The shower studio accepted and cleansed him. 10 minutes later, he was dry, shaved, groomed, and jaunting along the corridors of the inner sphere, heading inboard toward Catherine Tokugawa's executive office in the Corps. Heads turned as he floated past, but only one of the hotel guests had the nerve to call out to him.
"Hello, Jay. You look happy. Good news?"
Jay made a long arm and grabbed a jaunt loop, braked himself to a halt. His boss would have a fit if she ever heard that a mere guest had learned news of this importance before she did. But Eva Hoffman was more than just a guest. She had been a resident fixture in the Shimizu for 16 years now. He glanced around, mock conspiratorially.
"Are you sure those are your original eyes?"
Eva grinned. She was 116 years old and showed most of them, having, most unusually, given up controlling her appearance on her 100th birthday. She drew stares everywhere she went in the Shimizu these days, the most horrified of them coming from those guests whose own odometers had rolled past zero.
30 years ago, I'd have known exactly why you were looking so happy at twice the distance. So your brother's coming back up to stay, eh? Congratulations."
"Thanks, I'm excited."
"Me too. You two good work together. Bribara was a waste of air.
Well, she had her own way of doing things.
Yeah, wrong. Would you like me to take charge of his wife and daughter, or what's her name, Spaniel?
Eva, of course, knew perfectly well what Collie's name was.
Help them get reoriented to free fall their first day, show them around the mausoleum and all that, so that you and Ren can get right down to work.
He was touched by the offer. Eva was a Shimizu institution, and she did not offer her time lightly or often. She was one of very few guests who knew her way around the place as well as Jay, who did not need to follow some AI's trail of blinking lights to get where she was going.
I think I've got that covered, he said. But if they do need more help, I'll know where to come. Thanks, Eva.
She looked dubious.
Well, who have you got in mind?
Eva had a low opinion of most of the Shimizu staff orientators, which Jay shared.
The new kid, Iowa.
Seen him a couple of times, don't know him.
Oh, he's a natural spaceborn. That interested her.
Is that good? Will he know what it is they don't know?
Jay nodded.
Yeah, he's been dealing with mudfeet all his life, one way or another. The ones here are just richer, that's all.
I think he and Collie are really going to hit it off.
I'll have to meet him. I always wanted to get to know a spaceborn.
Diaghilev cleared his virtual throat.
1 minute, Jay.
Jay was still in deluxe country, the cheapest of the Shimizu's accommodations, the inner sphere suites with no windows onto space. It was time to jaunt.
I've got to go. Look, keep this absolutely top secret for at least another 15 minutes, okay?
12, my final offer.
Okay, I'll talk fast.
He kissed her wrinkled cheek and pushed off.
Drop by for a chat before dinner, all right? She called after him. Something I want to ask you.
He waved agreement without looking back. He passed quickly through the rest of the deluxe tier to the inmost core, jaunted past his own suite without stopping, and reached the executive offices on time. Warned of his arrival by Diaghilev, Tokugawa's own AI had materialized its personal executive assistant persona for him, rather than the front desk clerk avatar it would have shown to a guest.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Sasaki," she said.
Her voice was oddly flat and nasal, perhaps in an attempt to make her seem real.
"Good afternoon, Ms. Boswell."
"Miss Tokugawa will see you now."
The door to the inner sanctum dilated. Jay jaunted through it, brushing the doorway with his fingertips to decelerate himself to a stop inside. Catherine Tokugawa was sitting Kukan Zen in the center of her spherical office, dressed in black ceremonial robes, her back to him. At the sound of the door hissing shut behind him, she unlaced her fingers, unfolded her legs from lotus, and flexed at the waist, rotating until she faced him. He politely spun until their local verticals matched, and they exchanged a bow. Then they each took a seat, in the free-fall sense of the term, giving a short puff with their thrusters so that they backed away from each other and velcroed their backs and buttocks to opposing surfaces, Jay maneuvering to avoid sitting on the door he had just come through. They sat more or less simultaneously.
"Well," she said then, in the slow exhalation of one emerging from profound meditation. It was all bullshit, of course, and Jay knew it. If she had really been meditating, she'd have velcroed herself to a wall or some other support. A person who sits Kukan Zen in the center of a room in zero-G, unsecured, sooner or later ends up bumping against the air exhaust, and shutting down the airflow only causes a ball of exhaled carbon dioxide to accumulate and smother the meditator. The manager of the Shimizu was, as the job called for, one of those people who prize appearance over content, style over substance, and Rinzai Buddhism was merely part of her admittedly impressive act. To have actually practiced it would have been an inefficient use of time. But Jay was not about to let his boss know he saw through her, not when he was about to piss her off. He slowed his breathing, adjusting to her rhythm.
"My brother said yes," he told her. She smiled wearily. Tokugawa, he dared not let himself think of her as Kate while in her presence, was 160 centimeters long and massed 46 kilos. In free fall, her small size had the effect of making her seem to be a little farther away than she actually was, which made her seem just a little bit more crisply in focus than other people. She had stabilized her apparent age at 40 standard years, with silver streaks in her hair that were in different places each time he met her. Jay had no idea what her real age might be. She was the granddaughter of Nobutaki Tokugawa, who had succeeded Bryce Carrington as chairman of the board of the original SkyFac Consortium back before the turn of the millennium, and her family still controlled a large share of space industry today. She had their look of eagles, backed by a competence that few Tokugawas actually possessed anymore. She looked so much like the manager of the finest hotel in human space that her genuine fitness for the job was almost a happy accident. Neither attribute particularly impressed Jay, but then he had to work for her. "Good," she said quietly. "It was about time for something to go right." "Troubles, Miss Tokugawa?" Jay asked, testing the waters to see just how bad a time this was to bring up the matter of the 2-month escape clause Rand had wanted. She made a flicking away gesture. "Not really, just an infinity of minor nuisances."
"How minor? Is the house still pressurized?"
"For the moment," she replied dryly. "No, nothing serious. I've got a major economic summit coming up next month, and with so much weight I'm going to have to double security, and, excuse me, I could have sworn you just said you were going to double security."
"I did."
Jay stared. "There is no such quantity. You can't double infinity. God isn't as secure as a Shimizu guest." She grimaced. "If he had security like those five are going to have, Satan would never have gotten off a speech, much less a coup attempt. Their combined resources are..." She paused, and Jay waited, curious to hear what word she would choose. "Impressive," she finished, and he repressed an impulse to lift his eyebrows. Any personal fortune that impressed Catherine Tokugawa staggered Jay. "If they ask me to, I'll have to taste-test their food myself, and anything else they want."
"That does sound like a lot of pressure."
"Special diets, special requirements, protocol headaches. The Muslim needs to know where Mecca is at all times, precisely, and the Chinese wants me to have that Soto Zen Roshi flown in from top step to do Doku-san with him, and as for the American, well, never mind what she'll want. And, of course, each and every one of them must be honored and coddled and pampered precisely as much as the other four to the 10th decimal. Never mind that it's apples and..." She caught herself, glanced down at her meditation robes, and took a long, cleansing breath. "Never mind any of it. It's par for the course these days, and not your pigeon. About your brother, any problems I should be aware of?" Jay's turn to take a deep breath. "One potential glitch, but I'll make sure it doesn't express. Don't even give it a thought."
"Fine. What am I not thinking of?"
"He says he wants a 2-month trial period. He'll finish out for bar a season, but if his wife and daughter don't like it up here, he'll quit then." Her eyes closed momentarily, and the ghost of a frown chased across her brow. Those were the only external signs she gave. Those who choose style over substance are compelled to stay with style, no matter how tough it gets. But Jay knew she was furious, and here he was, a convenient and fully qualified target.
"Why couldn't his family have come up with him the last time?" she asked quietly.
"His wife was on deadline and couldn't leave her desk for more than a few days," Jay reminded her. "She's a writer. Remember, they thought he had at least 2 more seasons, 2 more years before the board would make a final choice, and only a 25% chance it would turn out to be him." Tokugawa had her hands clasped in the Kukanzen Mudra, but now she was unconsciously twiddling her thumbs. The effect was so ludicrous that he knew she would be even angrier if she became aware of it. He concentrated his gaze on her eyes. "True," she admitted grudgingly, "we are rushing him. His demand is reasonable. But if his wife decides she's a groundhog, the house loses face. Damn Prabhara, this is her fault." Privately, he disagreed. Prabhara could not help being a perpendicular. None of those poor unfortunates could. If anything, the situation was the fault of the Shimizu's board of directors for not simply picking a shaper. The 3-year rotating audition scheme had always seemed crack-brained to Jay. Something like this had been bound to happen. But his advice had been ignored, and now was not the time to mention it. The blame looked better on Prabhara than it did on him. "I'd better call in Martin," she said. "I hate speaking to the man, but this is his pigeon. Maybe he can..." Her voice trailed off disconsolately. Jay empathized completely. Even for a PR man, Evelyn Martin was a weasel. You wanted to bathe after talking with him on the phone. But he was gifted at spin control. A metaphorical light bulb seemed to appear over Jay's head. "You're not looking at this right," he said suddenly. "This isn't bad news. It's mitigated good news. All it takes is a little spin control."
"Explain."
"Look, all Martin's press release has to say is that Prabhara has canceled for medical reasons and that Porter has graciously consented to fill out her term. At the end of 2 months, maybe you have to announce that Porter has dropped out too and let Choi and Mazursky carry on competing from there, a minor kerfluffle. But most likely his wife and kid will love this place as much as everyone else does, so you announce then that he's been given the final position and has accepted. Either way, none of the board's face is lost. Your brother would accept that, not announce that we've picked him as the final winner until he's committed himself, and not announce that at all, ever, if he decides to opt out?
Gladly, I think. It gets him out of an impossible situation, too.
He had a rush of brains to the head. But you should bump him to the permanent salary right away. Her thumb stopped twiddling. Done. Mr. Cohn! Her AI materialized its lawyer persona between her and Jay, facing both of them. As always, Mr. Cohn reminded Jay of an impossibly motionless shark.
Yes, ma'am.
She gave instructions for the amendment of Rand's contract, relying on Cohn's legal software to translate her wishes from conversational English into lawyerese, and spoke her signature. At Jay's suggestion, she had Cohn upload a copy to Diaghilev so that Jay could pass the document on to Rand later that night. Then she dismissed the AI and turned back to Jay.
Sasaki.
Yeah?
You've earned your air today.
He smiled, the first sincere smile of the day. He felt as if he had just successfully matched orbits by eyeball without a computer. A terrestrial analogy might be walking a tightrope over an abyss.
Always nice to hear. I'll let you get back to your meditation.
Thank you, she said. But first your reward. You get to tell Martin about all this.
He grimaced.
It's true, then. No good deed goes unpunished.
Except those committed by star dancers. They seem to be exempt.
That's an idea, he said. I'll go out the airlock without a suit.
In space, she said, seeming to be quoting something, no one can hear you scream. Please yourself, but see Martin first.
Jay sighed.
Yes, boss, after I've eaten.
He had originally intended to call Eva Hoffman and beg off on the chat she had asked for, but now he needed to tell someone how relieved he was and how clever he had been in wiggling, at least for the moment, off the spot marked X. As he left Tokugawa's office, he consulted the mental list of people he trusted enough to share news like this, and, Ethan being history now, found only Eva's name. She was not an employee of the house plugged into that grapevine, nor did she fraternize much with the other guests, even the other permanents. Most of them considered her crazy. She was easy to talk to, and in his opinion she had more character and style than any 10 other people he knew. He had often thought that if Eva were, oh, say, 70 years younger, he might have considered turning hetero again for her. Hell, even 60 years younger. Telling Diaghilev to call ahead and announce him, he left the Corps and jaunted back outboard through both deluxe tier, peasant country, at least in Shimizu terms, and ultra-deluxe tier, the bourgeoisie, governors, national-level executives, and so forth, all the way to the prime tier, the outer suites with the most cubic and a naked-eye view of space. Eva's digs were in the prime plus hemi tier, the one whose view included Earth. She had chosen a suite offset from the center of that section so that the home planet did not completely dominate the view, a choice Jay approved of since he had made the same one himself. Her door opened for him when he reached it, and her voice bade him enter. Her suite was lavish and comfortable and hushed. As a longtime resident of the Shimizu, he knew the second most expensive thing in it was the hush. The third most expensive thing was the sheer cubic volume and the air that filled it. Jay was one of the half-dozen hotel staff with enough clout to rate quarters in the Prime Plus, and his own suite was a quarter the size of this one. Even by the standards of a permanent guest of the Shimizu, Eva was wealthy. Kate Tokugawa would have said that her assets were substantial, only a step below impressive. His eyes found Eva where they expected to, by the room's most expensive feature, floating within the 3-meter-across bubble window, called an IMAX for obscure historical reasons, which made the best prime-tier suites cost twice as much as the deluxe accommodations. As was her custom when at home, she was wearing only wings and fins, sculling them gently and quite unconsciously to hold her position in space against the gentle current of airflow. It was a sight he had seen countless times and still found striking and moving. A butterfly with a withered body. Rodin's She Who Was Once the Beautiful Holmier, somehow given the wings of a swan by the gods in clumsy compensation for the ruin of her beauty. Nobody looked 60 anymore these days. Certainly nobody whose real age had 3 digits. And Jay found Eva's defiant decay paradoxically entrancing, especially juxtaposed against the wings, modern and high-tech, and that absurdly expensive surround window, and the stars beyond, their steady fossil light unthinkably older than Eva could ever hope to be. He wished he had the nerve to use the image in a dance. But Eva never missed a premiere. She had been born back in the days when nudity was strongly taboo, and while she'd obviously come into the 21st century, he had noted that she was never nude save when closeted with intimates. Oddly, the thought had never once occurred to him that he would probably be free to use the image as he pleased one day all too soon, that it could not be long before Eva died. If it had, the thought would have saddened him. But there was something about Eva that kept him from having it. He politely removed his own clothing and let B-sized tugbots take charge of each garment. He did not bother to remove his own wrist and ankle thrusters. Eva didn't object to their emissions. She just didn't care to use thrusters herself if she didn't have to, and Jay felt far more naked without them than he did without clothes. Nonetheless, he allowed other tugbots to give him his own set of wings and fins, slide them on over his thrusters, and used them to join his hostess at the window. He was, if anything, more skillful at air swimming than she was. He simply preferred the superior kinetic and kinesthetic versatility thrusters offered. The jaunt to her side was uncomplicated. The room seemed as starkly furnished as a Zen master's cell, all its fabulous conveniences invisible until they were needed. That was its fourth most expensive feature. She rode the turbulence of his arrival expertly and helped him steady himself at the station beside her, just far enough away to allow them both wing room, all without taking her gaze from the window. She had chosen a local vertical that put Earth in the lower left quadrant of the window. Perhaps a fifth of the planet was visible, a lens-shaped slice of old home. The rest of the view was of eternity. They shared it in silence for perhaps a minute.
"Drink with me, Jay," she said then.
He didn't care much for alcohol as a rule. He hated what it did to his balance and kinesthetic sense. But he did not hesitate.
"Name your poison."
He told himself that it would anesthetize him against having to talk with Martin later.
"Jeeves," she called,
and her AI shimmered into view, oriented to her local vertical and seeming to be standing on air.
"Yes, madam."
"The good stuff."
One holographic eyebrow rose half a centimeter.
"Very good, madam."
Both of Jay's eyebrows rose at least that much. This was not going to be a casual conversation. He stopped rehearsing his account of how clever he had been in Kate's office. Chapter 5 Jeeves moved away without moving his legs, as if he were under gravity and his feet were on wheels, and ceased to exist when he left the human's peripheral vision. Tugbots delivered an amber bottle, two bulbs, and a spherical table to the spot where he had vanished. As they arrived, Jeeves reformed and picked them all out of the air expertly as he rolled back into view. He placed the table between Eva and Jay and told it to stay there, placed a bulb against either side of its Velcro surface and the bottle in the center facing them, so that the table looked like a stylized Pinocchio, and shimmied back a pace. Eva thanked and dismissed him. Once again, he glided out of view before dissolving. "I never thought I'd see that again," Jay said respectfully. She nodded. The bottle was an ancient quart of black bush, about three-quarters full. It was something like a century old, and its contents were 12 years older than that, a blend of whiskey so fine that at the time of its bottling it could not legally be exported from Ireland. Its source was the oldest distillery on Earth, whose charter to distill had been granted in 1608. There probably was not another bottle like it left anywhere in the solar system. Jay was the only person in the Shimizu besides herself who had ever seen it. They had shared a dram the night Ethan's goodbye message arrived from Terra. He steadied her while she poured, a process of pulling the bottle away while chasing it with the open end of the bulb, then pinching off the flow with one thumb while she sealed the bulb with the other. She did it better than the chief sommelier at the Hall of Lucullus, losing not a drop of the precious whiskey, fiercely proud of her ability to control her aged fingers. Jay accepted his bulb with thanks. He brought it up past his nose in a slow, gentle curve, squeezing slightly so that the nipple dilated and the bouquet came to him. When she had filled her own bulb and replaced the bottle, he raised his in salute, and they drank.
The silence stretched on.
"Silly," she said at last. "I'll never get over how silly it is."
"What's that?" he asked.
"You could blindfold me, tug me around the hotel enough to confuse me, lead me into any room in the place and dock me in front of its window, take off the blindfold and defy me without looking away from the window to tell you which tier I was in. There is no way to tell a real window from a fake one without instruments. And yet this thing is worth every yen it costs me, about the gross annual product of a medium town, and I'd pay three times as much if I had to. Why?"
He seemed to know a rhetorical question when he heard it. He made no reply.
"Why are they so goddamn happy, Jay?" she asked then.
"Who?" She gestured at the earth.
"Them."
Her gesture widened to take in orbital space, then widened farther.
"All of them. Our species. The human race in this year of our Lord 2064. I think I know why the Star Dancers are happy, but why people, too?"
"I'm not sure exactly what you mean."
"Exactly. That's what I mean."
She squeezed more whiskey into her mouth, rolled it around, and swallowed. God, she missed her taste buds sometimes.
"They probably don't even seem all that happy to you, do they?"
"Oh, I never really thought about it.
Trust me, I've been watching the human race a long time. At this point, we ought to be more traumatized than ever before in our history. The curve of change is almost vertical by now, like a goosing finger. You do know about the curve?"
"Sure." Of course he did, as a dry old chestnut from a history lesson. For millennia, the curve of human social and technological progress had trended upward, but so slowly as to be almost imperceptible. Then all at once it had passed some critical threshold and begun climbing sharply. Ever more sharply, the rate of increase itself accelerating steadily, until the race lurched from covered wagons to spaceships, from kingdoms and fiefs to planetary government, from chronic global poverty to staggering near-universal wealth in a single century. Remarkable. Inexplicable. Where would it all end? And so on. But Eva had been born into the middle of that century, just about the time it was beginning to dawn on humanity just how oddly the curve was behaving. And humanity's general response had been to run a high fever.
"I don't mean trivial things like conquering cancer. I mean substantive changes in the map of reality. When I was a girl, the phrase New World still meant North America. Now it means Mars. The Old World, that one right there, is just about unrecognizable if you look at it any closer than this. The population has more than doubled since I was born, and look at that planet, it's still green. All the most fundamental axioms of politics, of economics, of industry have all come apart since the turn of the millennium, obsoleted by new technology. We seem to have a handle on pollution, for God's sake. After half a century of holding my breath, I'm prepared to admit that it looks like we really may have outgrown war. Thanks to nanotechnology, I'm even getting ready to concede that a day may come when we'll have outgrown money. A day when no one alive has to work to earn her living, when nobody will remember or care what a salary was or why people gave up a third of their lives to get one."
"And you wonder why people are happy?"
"Yes, two axioms I cling to are that change is painful and that humans react poorly to pain. Change that radical and fundamental has to hurt, to confuse, to anger. For the first 70 years of my life, I watched my species grow ever more neurotic, more sullen, more despairing, more bitter. You know what I'm talking about."
"Well, I've read about it, seen records, old flat screens, and so forth."
"They don't convey it. Believe what I'm about to tell you. When I was 45 years old, 95% of the intelligent, thoughtful, university-educated people I knew believed as an article of faith that technology and change were dooming the planet and that some of us would live to see the last days. Just about every one of them had a different candidate for what specifically was going to get us. Nuclear winter was the big one until the Soviet Union went broke. Within about 15 minutes, 50 other ends of everything had moved in to replace it. Global warming, ice age, the ozone layer, overpopulation, deforestation, dwindling resources, pollution, energy shortage. I can't even remember them all anymore. Pestilence, famine, and plague were evergreen favorites, and you could always find someone who was putting his money on a runaway comet. If you had a taste for the exotic, you could be terrified of flying saucers and empires of alien cattle mutilators, but just about every adult I knew clutched some form of ultimate paranoia to his or her breast. Almost without exception, they chose to believe that the end of all meaning was just over the horizon. If you didn't know that, you were too stupid or naive to be worth talking to. I'm overstating it slightly because the sample I'm talking about consisted almost exclusively of affluent North Americans. But only slightly. In 1991, a major poll asked average Americans if they would like to live 500 years, assuming that could be accomplished cheaply and comfortably. Only half of them said yes. Fully half of that society was looking forward to dying.
Jay frowned and took a drink of his whiskey, forgetting to savor it. How weird it must have been to live in an age when the brightest and best worshipped Henny Penny, when the crew of Starship Earth, wealthy beyond the wildest dreams of their ancestors, were on the verge of mutinous panic. She nodded.
And then right at the turn of the millennium, just as the worst thing possible happened, and the wildest of all those paranoid fantasies came true, just as actual aliens appeared in the sky, changed our destiny for us in great and incomprehensible ways, and vanished again before we could ask them any questions, everybody calmed down. The curve kept on rising faster than ever, and somehow everybody on Earth seemed to heave a great sigh and kick back and relax. Not right away, no, not all at once. But the damn planet has been getting slowly and steadily saner for over 60 years now, and it's driving me crazy.
He swirled whiskey around in his bulb, stared through and past the oscillating golden liquid to the planet they both had left forever.
"Doesn't seem all that sane to me," he said.
"No, I'm sure it doesn't to someone your age," she agreed. "Well, it isn't all that sane, but it's saner. Do you know that at one time the United States had 10% of its population imprisoned, justly, as the best solution they could devise to problems they didn't begin to understand? Every year the papers told you the crime rate was rising. It's been falling for over 20 years now, and somehow that never makes the headlines. The media just aren't geared up to report good news. You have to dig that out for yourself."
"Oh, I think it has to do with that curve you were talking about," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, the latest spike in the curve, the nanotechnological revolution. Molecular-scale machines and computers. It's qualitatively different from the Industrial Revolution or the Silicon Revolution or any of those. For once, we got a new technology that cleans up its own wastes, doesn't despoil anything we cherish, and produces so much new wealth nobody could steal it all. Our first healing revolution. Well, take the revolution you grew up with, Eva, nuclear fission. They told everyone it would produce power too cheap to meter. Then it turned out the plants were big kludges, and nobody's power bill seemed to go down a dollar. No wonder they stopped trusting people in lab coats. But this generation got a technology that delivered on its promises."
He sipped his drink again, appreciating it this time.
"And come to think of it, that was mostly thanks to the Stardancers. Without them and their safe lab, we'd still be skirting the edges of nanotechnology, too scared of someone getting a monopoly on it, or scared of the wrong little nano-assembler getting loose and turning all the iron to peanut butter or something. Or we might have destroyed the planet in a war for possession of the new technology," she agreed. "Instead, we've got a UN that means something, and a repaired ozone layer, and a healthy ecosystem, and non-polluting industry, and a world so fat and rich it hasn't even had a serious local war for 30 years.
"The Stardancers kept us honest," he said. "Thanks to the Fireflies, we had a precious resource, people we could trust to be above human greed and avarice, people with nothing to gain, people who could not be bribed or coerced.
Bodhisattvas," she said.
"If you like," he said. "Fair witnesses, anyway."
"No wonder there used to be terrorists trying to kill them. A fair witness can be infuriating."
"Yeah, maybe, but the last serious attempt was about the time I was born. Even a fanatic reactionary can see they're just too valuable to the race now. They can live full-time in space with no life support, and space is the only safe place to develop little artificial viruses, the only sensible place to collect solar power. Humanity got lucky. We got just what we needed, just when we needed it."
"Luck, hell!" she snarled.
He recoiled at her force.
"You just said it yourself. Luck had nothing to do with it. It was those damned Fireflies. They saved our bacon for us, brought us the moon full of symbiote that makes a human a star dancer, and gave it to us for free. I could kill them for that."
She could see that she had shocked him. She waited to see how he would handle it. "This is what you really wanted to talk about," he said finally. She smiled.
"Pour for us, please, Jeeves."
When the AI had refreshed their bulbs, she turned to face him directly. He copied her, and they joined a hand to steady themselves in the new attitude. She held on.
"Jay," she said, "I'm old. I was old enough to vote when the first tourist littered the moon. I was spending a fortune on cosmetic camouflage the year the Fireflies showed up and Shara Drummond danced the star dance for them. I've had a 5-cent Coca-Cola, and watched the first television set on my block, flat-screen monochrome. I've owned 78 RPM phonograph records and a hand-crank Victrola. I've buried 3 husbands, 3 children, and 2 grandchildren. One of my great-grandchildren in Canada is dying, and I have to keep asking Jeeves her name. Jeeves, what is my dying great-grandchild's name?"
"Charlotte, madam," Jeeves murmured from somewhere nearby.
"I have been a success in 3 professions," she went on, "and a failure in 2. It's not that most of my life is behind me. All of my life is behind me, receding. I always said I was going to check out when and if my clock showed 3 figures, and I came here to the Shimizu for that purpose. I stopped controlling my cosmetic age the day I moved into this suite as a sign that I was withdrawing from human affairs. I've been saying goodbye for the last 16 years. You know most of this."
He nodded and sipped the Irish whiskey, still holding her hand.
"Haven't you ever wondered what's taking me so long?"
He shook his head. "Not once. I figure saying goodbye to life could take me 17 years easy."
"You'll find out," she said. "Old age is not for sissies. I had all my goodbyes said years ago."
"All right," he said agreeably. "I'll play Mr. Interlocutor. Why are you still using up air, Miss Hoffman?"
"Sheer annoyance," she said. "I'd always expected to live to see the world end. I planned to watch humanity die of its own stupidity and meanness and chortle at the irony of it all. I expected to enjoy it immensely."
"I can understand that," he said slowly.
"Well, long before I came up here, I admitted to myself that it just isn't going to happen any time soon. Okay, I didn't insist on doom, as so many of my contemporaries had. I would have settled for watching us come through in the clutch, reach deep inside ourselves and pull out the best of us and solve our damn problems."
She glanced down at her bulb, found too much whiskey there, and corrected the problem.
"What I wasn't prepared for was to have big red fireflies drop in and fix things for us, and then scamper off to wherever the hell they came from without telling us why."
She looked into his eyes for understanding and did not find it. He was too young for questions like this to be troubling in anything but an abstract sense. And he had grown up in a world where telepathic star dancers, and the mysterious alien fireflies who had appeared out of nowhere, created the star dancers and their collective star mind, and then vanished back into deep space, were prosaic history, something that had happened 16 years before he was born. She saw him try to understand, and fail. She broke eye contact and sculled around to face the window and the world again.
"Anyway, it's come to me in the last few days that what I've been doing, what I've been waiting for, has been for the damned fireflies to come back from wherever they went and tell us what's going on, or for me to cleverly deduce it for myself. The most important philosophical question the human race has faced since the aliens dropped in and out again is, what the hell was that? In 64 years, we haven't made a dent in it. Realizing that has forced me to face the fact that I'm wasting my time. If nobody else can figure it out, I probably can't either. Available evidence indicates the fireflies drop by once every couple of thousand years at best. I can't wait that long. And this steady diet of unearned good news lately has just got me baffled."
"Are you sure it's unearned?" he said. "Star dancers start as human beings, however different they may become after symbiosis. The scientific name for them is Homo coelestis. Humanity birthed them. The fireflies were just midwives."
"Star dancers do not suffer from fear or hunger or poverty or lust or loneliness," Eva said. "Thanks to their symbiote, they're immortal, effectively invulnerable, and perpetually loved. As far as I'm concerned, that means they're not human anymore. And if things keep going the way they are, it's conceivable that one day nobody on Earth may be hungry or cold or oppressed. If that day comes, by my lights, there won't be any human beings anymore."
"So you want to leave while things are still miserable?" he said. She frowned at her drink.
No, she said. That's my point. Everybody's happy now.
I personally think that in time the hangover will arrive, and people will find out that even nanotechnology has hidden costs. No matter how many miracles we come up with, I believe there are always limits to growth. I have a friend named Ling who says he can prove it. I can't follow his math, but it sounds convincing. But meanwhile, there is peace on the world. Maybe it's only temporary, but nobody can know that yet, so maybe this is a good time to leave, and I should stop dragging my feet.
He kept his face expressionless. How do you plan to do it? His very neutrality cued her that he was angry. It startled her. She precessed to face him again.
Is that relevant?
Well, it's closer than anything that's been said since I jaunted in here, he said. Let's cut through all the bullshit about star dancers and fireflies and how happy the world is today.
You have obviously decided to check out. For some reason, you think I need to know that in advance. That means you have some role in mind for me. I'm curious to know what it is. You want me to stand by with the ceremonial sword in case you lose your nerve? Am I supposed to talk you out of it, or just be your witness and hold your hand? Angel's advocate, enabler, or audience, I can go any way you like, Eva. I'm your friend, and I'll try to give you whatever you need of me, but you've got to tell me the steps.
She let go of her drink and reached toward him with her withered hands. He abandoned his own drink and took them in his own.
In a month, she said, Reb Hawkins will be coming to the Shimizu. I want to talk with him one more time. Immediately after that, I plan to go out the airlock.
She gestured toward the window with her chin.
Out there. When I'm ready, my pea suit will kill me, painlessly and not abruptly. I want to die in space. As I die, I would like to watch you dance, if you're willing.
He was speechless. He tried to free his hands, and she would not let him. He tried to tear his gaze from her, and she would not allow that either.
"Why me?" he said finally.
"Dance is the only thing humans do that's only beautiful," she said. "It's the only thing we do that speaks even to fireflies, as far as we can tell. I want to die watching a human being dance. A human, not a star dancer. You're the best dancer I know, and you're my friend. I thought about not putting this on you until the last minute, but I thought you might want some time to choreograph your dance. I know how busy you'll be once your brother arrives."
Globules of salt water began to grow from his eyes. Despite 16 years in free fall, she still found the sight of zero-G tears simultaneously hilarious and moving. And contagious. He shook his head and the droplets flew away. She blinked back her own and waited. At last, with difficulty, he smiled.
"I am honored, Eva," he said.
He released her hands, plucked his bulb out of the air, and raised his arm in a toast. She reclaimed her own, and they emptied them together. She did not hesitate, spun and threw her bulb as hard as she could directly at that absurdly expensive window. The bulb shattered musically. She had startled him. A cannon couldn't have broken that window, but still, what a gesture! He was game, though. His own bulb burst only a second or two after hers. When they had recovered from their throes, he bowed to her, a Buddhist gassho she suspected he must have learned from his grandmother. She returned it gravely.
"Thank you," she said.
There was nothing left to say, or too much. After they had watched the tugbots chase and disassemble glass shards for a few moments, he cleared his throat and said, "I've got to see Ev Martin before dinner." She grinned.
"Another argument for suicide. You're right, you wouldn't want to talk to him on a full stomach."
"Not even on a stomach full of 100-year-old whiskey," he agreed, "but it'll help. Thanks for it." She made a mental note to leave him the balance of the bottle in her will. He paused at the door.
"Eva?"
"Yes,"
she said without turning.
"Is it all right if I spend the next month trying to get you to change your mind?"
"Yes,"
she said. "But don't be attached to succeeding, Jay. I've been thinking about this a long time."
After a while, she heard the door close and seal.
"Well, I have to stop now, but if you don't want to, you can always go over to www.blackstoneaudio.com and buy yourself the entire novel. It's available in a variety of formats, from cassette to MP3. Before I do leave you, I must give my warmest thanks to all of you wonderful, generous people, both real and virtual, whose subscriptions and donations, both here in Consensus Reality and on Second Life, literally made it possible for me to be there in New York to sing to my granddaughter, and is making it possible now for Jeannie to be there supporting the new mother for another week. I cannot tell you how much we appreciate having had that golden and priceless opportunity. I'd also like to thank our dear friend Stephanie McDowell, who drove Jeannie's Portuguese great-grandmother's rocking chair all the way across the continent so Jeannie's granddaughter could be nursed in it. Obrigado, Stevie. I'm told that photos of Marissa Alegria are up on Facebook, and at least a couple can be found on the blog at Jeannie's site, stardancemovie.com, and I hope to have a few on my own website, too, just as soon as Colin and I both get a moment to spare. This year, I hope. I'll close with one last lullaby from the great Brian Breeze Kaol, and I'd like to dedicate it both to Marissa Alegria and to Brian and Tracy's son, Jude. This is Gospel Lullaby from the Breeze's impeccable album, State of My Heart.
all its predecessors, Spider on the Web number 67 has been brought to you under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Dumb grasshopper.